been proceeding. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Wallach. May it please the Court, John O'Quinn on behalf of the appellant. This is a classic case of obviousness under KSR. Mallinckrodt overreached to claim all oxymorphone compositions that meet the FDA-mandated standard, no matter how they are made, even when made with well-known prior techniques. And this isn't a patent on Mallinckrodt's particular process. It has another patent that claims its process. This is just a patent on the composition itself. And with respect to that, I respectfully submit that the key facts are undisputed. The issue before the court is what conclusion to draw from them.
Now, Mr. O'Quinn, you argue that the FDA and its mandate identified the problem, which is that oxymorphone impurity, and put forth a solution, reducing concentrations to 10 parts per million or lower for ABUK, and that this provided a person of skill motivation to combine the prior art. How does an unspecified mandate to purify oxymorphone motivate a person of skill to combine the prior art in this case? Doesn't the FDA simply motivate a person to solve the general problem?
So I agree, Judge Wallach, that what you have is akin to the Norgin case, quoting KSR, where what you have is a known problem for which there was an obvious solution. And what this case, I think, looks a lot like is this court's decision in Dystar, which was a pre-KSR case, but nonetheless recognized that there's an inherent motivation that comes from the prior art when you have a technology-independent problem.
So the FDA's notification is irrelevant then?
Well, I think the FDA's notification is a motivation as to why a person of ordinary skill in the art would want to have low ABUK oxymorphone. And oftentimes when you're fighting about what was the motivation, that's what you're fighting about, which is why would anyone even think to do this?
But wait, just for a second. I mean, if the prior art combination is Weiss in view of Chapman,
sure.
How does that general statement from the FDA, which I agree is strong evidence of something, how does that show specifically that one of ordinary skill in the art would have been motivated to modify Weiss in view of Chapman?
Yeah, I don't think we're not arguing that the FDA provided a specific reference or motivation to combine specific prior art references. What the FDA did was provide a motivation to use the prior art to solve the problem.
To solve the problem. The question, I mean, you're saying, well, there was an obvious solution here. That's the question in the case.
Sure.
The big debate is whether or not Weiss and Chapman, in the eyes of one of ordinary skill in the art, says, aha, it's obvious.
I think that's right, Judge Clement.
Is oxycodone the same thing as oxymorphone?
No, there's a slight difference between in terms of the chemical structure, there's a slight difference. Oxycodone has a methoxy group attached to it, whereas oxymorphone has a hydroxy group attached to it. Now, oxycodone is in fact a precursor to oxymorphone, and they are closely related. Indeed, this patent itself is predominantly, if you read the specification, a patent about purifying or reducing ABUKs in oxycodone.
But we can't rely on that as evidence, right? I mean, that would be hindsight, right? To look at the specification in that way, use the specification to say, this invention uses the same process, so therefore it must work. We can't do that.
No, not at all, Judge Stoll. That wasn't my point. My point was to the extent that there's a suggestion that there's some vast difference between oxycodone and oxymorphone, I think that is belied by the prior art, like Weiss itself. And I was just making the point that, indeed, in terms of the processes the patentee came up with here, their own process applies to both as well. But my point is not that you look at the fact that theirs work for oxycodone in any way as being dispositive. But coming back to the question that you asked, Judge Clevenger, I think in some sense the issue about the FDA notice is a little bit of a red herring, because at the end of the day, there's no dispute that that is what motivated a person of ordinary skill in the art to want to solve the problem. There's no dispute that the prior art taught.
What else does it tell us? What else does the FDA mandate tell us for purposes of deciding this case?
Sure. I think it tells you a couple of things. One is...
I mean, it'd be like if there were a market demand for something and everybody said, well, gee whiz, I'd love it if an iPhone could do this or that.
Well, I think that gets back to KSR. I mean, KSR teaches that market demand...
What is it you want the FDA mandate to do? You want it to combine Weiss and Chapman? What do you want to happen?
I think that in many cases, the dispute is why would a person...
You're not answering my question. I mean, I couldn't understand in the briefing what it was that once I decided that the FDA mandate meant what you thought it meant, what difference did it make to the case?
Well, Judge Clevenger, I think it does a couple of things. One, the fact that the FDA issued this mandate and the fact that that is what everyone responded to in the industry and responded within a couple of years is highly relevant to the issue of simultaneous invention. I think it's
really
also,
that it took them a couple of years to do it when it was so obvious.
Well, Judge Wallach, you look at what the time was in the context of this is a drug that had been around for 100 years, had been approved by the FDA for 60 years. The FDA issues a mandate, and everyone responds to it in a couple of years' time. It's very similar
to
the facts in George.
There's a large market for this stuff, right?
Well,
and the FDA was saying what you're now selling isn't going to be on the market anymore.
Well, and I think that
that's what urges folks to leap forward.
Let me put it this way.
I still don't understand. I mean, your brief made a whole mountain out of the district court ignoring the FDA mandate or failing to treat it properly. I still don't understand what it is you want me to do with it.
Well, I think at the end of the day, the significance of the FDA mandate for this particular case is this. In many cases, the idea, where the idea comes from, is itself evidence that the invention is not obvious. The fact that somebody wouldn't have thought...
Right, but you're talking about it in terms of making you to combine the references. And then I'm saying, well, combine... I couldn't understand that because it looked to me like the district court had, Chapman in one hand and Weiss in the other, and is looking at both at the same time, trying to figure out whether either one or in combination get the trick done.
Sure.
Right? So that's combining references as far as I can tell. So what else would the FDA mandate have been doing? So I'm trying my best to pay careful attention to your brief and figure out what you're telling me, and I keep coming up, with nothing.
Well, respectfully, Judge Clevenger, I don't think there's anything that I'm going to say today that's going to add any significance to the FDA mandate. Let's move past that.
Can I ask you a question, though? Okay.
Sure, Judge.
Let's say I agree with you that the FDA mandate is priority under 102F, and I agree that it should be relevant to the obviousness determination in some way.
Sure.
How do I get around the fact that I think that Judge Andrews, while he used some strong language at some parts and said it's not relevant, and he later addressed it, at least with respect to reasonable expectation of success, at page JA30.
Right.
I mean, how do you get around that fact-finding there where he says that the FDA mandate wouldn't have provided a person of ordinary skill in the art with a reasonable expectation of success? Isn't that a fact-finding?
Judge Stoll, I think that the question of whether or not the FDA mandate would by itself, which is all he addresses at JA30, whether that would provide a reasonable expectation of success is not the proper question for him to be asking in this case. The question is, would the prior art, which of course would include Weiss and Chapman, would that provide a person of ordinary skill in the art a reasonable expectation of success? And respectfully, he never answers that question. He never addresses Weiss or Chapman in the issue of reasonable expectation of success. In fact, the only thing he ultimately says about them is that they did not provide a, quote, definitive solution. That's at Appendix 24. And that's the only place that he talks about them.
I understand you have that separate argument.
Sure.
Okay. And I understand that. But I was trying to understand, with respect to your argument specifically about the FDA mandate, I understand your points, about there's some positions taken with respect to whether it's relevant or whether it's prior art. But then, regardless, the judge seems to at least consider the FDA mandate. How do I deal with that?
Sure. I don't think that there's anything inconsistent with the way that he considered the FDA mandate and ultimately our argument that what the FDA mandate does is provide a strong reason for a person to want to solve the problem of purifying oxymorphone. And that then leads you to the question of, okay, what with the tools that the person of ordinary skill in the art had available to them, what would they have been able to do and what would they have reasonably expected? And
we know the FDA mandate like your primary reference? And then you'd modify or use Weiss. I mean, I'm just trying to go back to the point that Judge Clevenger was making and trying to really understand what, in your view, it adds to the mix.
Well, what I think it adds to the mix is it is the market motivation that KSR talks about. KSR talks about when deciding questions of obviousness, the question isn't just do you find something together in the prior art and it says please combine X with Y or think about combining X with Y and maybe you'll get some good result. KSR threw all that out and said no, you can look to market conditions and other demands in deciding what to do with prior art. And so what the FDA mandates...
Whether or not to combine prior art.
Sure. And what
but I mean... Why didn't what in what respect did the district court fail to combine prior art in this case?
Well,
fail to combine it.
I don't know that the district court at the end of the day failed to combine.
Well, then what's your argument?
My argument is that
on the FDA issue.
Well, my argument with respect to the FDA issue is that the district court didn't look at this case through the lens of KSR. It treated the FDA mandate as being irrelevant. It says that.
If the court had, given the findings that the court made, wouldn't the mandate cut against you? The strong motivation to combine, right? And you say a person of skill in the art would know instantly that it's obvious to take that action, right? Given that strong mandate, why didn't they?
They did, Judge Wallach.
I don't think that's true.
The issue with respect to catalytic hydrogenation...
Not based on the findings of the court and the evidence before us from your opposing counsel. They themselves did multiple experiments involving both those references and others.
So there's a lot there, and it's kind of the crux of what I had hoped to talk about today. So
I know you're well in here.
Let me say a few words about that, because number one, when you look at the district court's opinion, the only place he addresses catalytic hydrogenation. And catalytic hydrogenation, we submitted, and you can see at Appendix 2026, quote from the inventor of, and it's within a brief, but it's a quote from the inventor of the Dung patent. And the Dung patent, which was involved in the interference with their patent, uses catalytic hydrogenation using the same catalyst as involved in Weiss and involved in Chapman in very similar conditions in terms of temperature, pressure, and so forth, and achieves the result.
So I just to make sure I understand your argument, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but are you saying Dung, which was post the invention?
Yes.
It's not prior art.
It's not prior art.
You're saying that that shows that Weiss would have worked?
Yes, it does. It absolutely does. And indeed, that's exactly what Dr. Gogol testified to at a number of places in the record, Appendix 3038 to 3039 and 3042. And
that was subject to factual dispute, though, right?
Well, it's not a dispute that the district court resolved, and that's a key point here. When you the issue is this: they don't claim a process; they claim the low ABUK oxymorphone, no matter how made. And our argument is that it would have been obvious to a person of ordinary skill in the art that you could make low ABUK using, among other things, catalytic hydrogenation. The district court doesn't ever address the testimony from the co-inventor of the Dung patent at Appendix 2026 at 3024.
Just be aware, when that red light goes on, I'm going to make you stop.
Yeah. Well, the last thing that I want to say then is we also have an issue of anticipation. The district court here rewrote the claims to say what Mallinckrodt wished that they had said instead of what they actually claimed. And I'd point you specifically to claim 4, which is itself the chemical structure formula for the 14-hydroxymorphenone. And they want to say that, even though they went to the trouble of actually laying out the chemical structure formula for 14-hydroxymorphenone free base, and it's undisputed that's what it was, that that actually should be read as being 14-hydroxymorphenone hydrochloride. That's inconsistent with this court's precedents, and at a minimum, this court should reverse the finding, reverse the claim construction, and with it falls anticipation.
I want to ask you a quick yes or no question, which is...
I'll do my best.
Okay, thank you. In the court's opinion, it suggests that you argued that there should be no reasonable expectation of success requirement. Is that correct?
I think there were some arguments below about whether or not that stands alone as a separate independent requirement, and that's not an issue that we're pursuing on appeal.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to give you a couple of minutes.
Thank you, Judge Wallach. Understood.
May it please the court. We had a trial in this case, the district court. We had experts who appeared. We had a theory that was proposed, which was that hydrogenation was somehow in the air, and the FDA mandate would have caused everyone to simply make low-A-buck oxymorphone. The district court made very strong credibility findings with respect to the experts. He found that their position was not credible. Their burden was clear and convincing evidence. The FDA mandate is exactly what the judge said it was. It was a motivation to get to work. What's interesting about the case is the evidence, as Your Honor pointed out, showed that when a handful of companies who were capable of working with opioids did get to work, they had enormous problems in making low-A-buck oxymorphone. Mallinckrodt did several dozen experiments using hydrogenation, using double hydrogenation. They hired catalyst experts. They tried the most modern catalysts. They hired someone who was called a hydrogenation expert.
Let me be clear about this, because this is where I read the record. Those were seriatim.
Correct.
Yeah.
They were those were seriatim. What they actually did is they started a research plan where they said, we have no idea whether right. this is going to work. It wasn't even the testing methodology for determining at that low level what the concentrations are was new. So they tried bisulfite, which is what they eventually ended up patenting. They tried hydrogenation many times, failed. They tried chromatography. They tried another technique.
Do you maintain the position that the FDA mandate is not relevant at all to motivation and it's not prior art?
No, the judge, I look at it this way. The judge clearly considered it, and he considered it for what it was worth, the motivation for people to get to work. The 102F point is kind of an interesting one. How does 102F relate to 103? What's prior art? I mean, if we filed a patent application today, I suppose yesterday's Washington Post would be a prior publication, and it would count. It wouldn't really be prior art.
Would it be fair to call it a motivation to act?
Yes, it would. Motivation to act, a motivation
but
to get
still
to work.
Relevant.
It's relevant.
It still could be prior art. Something could be prior art and not have any relevance at all to the invention claimed. But it's still prior art, right?
Right. And I think what the judge was reacting to, is that really prior art if it doesn't add anything?
But that's not how the law works, is it?
It isn't. No, it certainly has to be considered in the obviousness analysis, just like, as you pointed out, a market demand. That's what this really was. It was a market demand. We wouldn't ordinarily, as lawyers who work in the patent area, say if there was a strong market demand that demand was prior art. It's considered in the obviousness analysis. It's merely a matter of semantics. And the district judge, as you pointed out, did consider the FDA mandate. He just didn't think it was enough to get them over the hurdle.
Can I ask you another question? This
yes.
is on the reasonable expectation of success standard. And I just want to ask you about one sentence, and maybe you can explain what you think it means. So it's on page JA26, and it's the third line. And it starts, there is no evidence that anyone ever combined these methods prior to the invention date, and Dr. Gokul himself never did any experiments to show they work, semicolon. He merely opined that a person of ordinary skill would have thought to try it and would have expected it to work. Now, this is my question. Why isn't it enough that he opined that he would have expected it to work? Why does it have to be that Dr. Gokul did experiments or that there's required that there's evidence that anyone ever actually combined these methods? That would be anticipation, I would think.
Well, I don't think there's anticipation. I think the judge was saying was he was recounting what Dr. Gokul's testimony was. In Dr. Gokul's view, this, that, or the other thing would have happened. There would have been an expectation of success. Dr. Davies testified in an imposing way, and the judge made credibility findings against them. It's closely related to a fact which, in this case, is almost makes this case almost unique. In an obviousness case, the law says you look at the prior art, look at the differences between the prior art and the claimed invention, then we apply the analysis. But there's an underlying assumption, which is that when you make the combination, that you actually will result in the claimed invention. It's an enablement, In re Kumar. The combination has to be able to make the invention. There was no evidence in this case that if you took Chapman, modified it in some fashion, that you would result in low ABUC oxymorphone. None. Counsel pointed to Dung. The evidence in the case was that Dung started with oripivine, a unique starting material. All other opioid synthesis starts with thebaine because that's what you get when you first process poppy straw. That was a different process. The problem they had with the case is they never identified a reaction path that would have led to low ABUC oxymorphone. So there was nothing for the court to look at and say, oh, that reaction path differs from Chapman in this fashion, and it would have been obvious to make that modification. They didn't do that. Now, we asked Dr. Gokul at this trial.
Just to make sure I understand what you're saying, this sentence is really going to whether the combination as a whole enables one of ordinary skill in the art to reach the claim, which is as opposed to the question of reasonable expectation
right.
of success.
I think he's saying Dr. Gokul said there was an expectation of success, but we don't even know whether this thing would have made low ABUC oxymorphone. Normally, in an obviousness case, you have, say, in an electrical case, you've got a circuit, and all the components are known, and somebody says, well, nobody knew how to put them all together, and the question is, was it obvious to put them together in the way that the inventor did? But you almost never have any doubt about, if you put the things together that are claimed to be the prior art, whether you'd result in the claim. Here, you don't know what would have been. Chapman, by itself, does not make oxymorphone, low ABUC. It makes oxycodone. Their argument was, well, you'd modify Chapman, but how? We don't know.
Well, what about, I mean, you know, there's also some common sense thought that when the FDA says, we want you to make this with an ABUC of a certain parts per million, that there's some sort of common sense thought that they expect it to be able to work.
I
understand I'm not the fact finder. I just want to press you on this.
Sure, I understand. Regular order here when we have obviousness cases. You've got to point to the things that are in the prior art. You've got to prove that those things, when combined, would reach the claimed invention.
Well, whether there's a reasonable expectation.
The first, I don't think so. I think the predicate to even get to the starting gate is to show a combination that would actually make the invention. If not,
well, then what's the reasonable expectation of success about? Success is making the invention.
Right. The reasonable expectation would be that, now you could have a situation where you have in my circuit.
Well, just stop. I mean, what's, in your view, the reasonable expectation of success has no purpose?
No, it has a major purpose. It's just you don't get there unless the combination would, at the end of the day, make the invention.
Oh, you mean if it would have been obvious to make the invention?
No, we have a deeper problem.
Then you don't care whether there was a reasonable expectation of success?
We have a deeper problem that if Chapman can't be modified to make low ABUC oxymorphone, then they don't have an obviousness.
How does that not subsume the reasonable expectation, the way you're looking at it in terms of enablement?
It's subsumed.
How does it not subsume the reasonable expectation of success?
It's subsumed. First, you have to show the combination would work. And then the question is, would it have been reasonable for people to make the combination? Would it have been obvious to put the combination together?
Why would it have been unreasonable to do it once you knew it worked? I mean, that's my problem with your argument.
No, Your Honor. You often have cases where there are multiple pieces of things from different areas and the inventor says...
And one of ordinary skill in the art would be motivated to put them together. And Hosanna, when they put them together, they got at the level the FDA wanted you to.
That's right. But the problem...
Well, then, if that's the case, then what on earth does the reasonable expectation of success have to do with the obvious...
I'll give you an example. Well,
let me interject. I think this is where you're going. You're saying, step one, is there any is there any possibility of success?
Yes. Yes.
Because if there's no possibility of success, there can't be any reasonable expectation.
That's another way to put it. For example, if you took example, whatever, four from Chapman...
Okay, so apply that to our case, and you say there's Chapman, there's Weiss, there are a number of different ways to fiddle with this molecule.
But we don't know whether...
And one of ordinary skill in the art would say, well, there's a possibility, because you can use these tools. That gets you by where the presiding judge is. Fine, well, nobody's arguing about whether that particular problem was met in this case. Of course it was.
No, no, there's
the question
no...
then is you've got your expert says, well, if you take Weiss or Chapman or any other models and you tinker with them and you tinker with them, the problem is you can't, there is no reasonable expectation you're going to get to the goal line.
That's correct.
Because the molecule keeps changing. It makes the stuff you don't want. And then when you get rid of that, it makes some more stuff you didn't want. Right?
Yes, Your Honor. That's
and
exactly
the other side simply said, as you would expect it to say, said, well, would there be a reasonable expectation of success if you tinkered? Of course there would be.
Right. And of course,
so there's a fact finding on that motivation
yes,
issue. And the question in our case is, was the judge clearly erroneous? Yes or no?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And my only point was that this
don't say it just to appease me.
No, it's correct, Your Honor. Well,
we've been going around in lots of circles, you know what I mean?
The bottom line is this is, in some ways, this is a very straightforward case. The district judge made fact, and that's how I started. The district judge made factual findings. He made credibility findings. It's an obviousness case. My only point was this is an unusual obviousness case because they didn't even show that the thing they claimed rendered the claims obvious could actually have enabled and made the claim.
Is 14-hydroxymorphone referred to anywhere in the claims or broader specification as a hydrochloride?
It's the claims refer to they just have the word 14-hydroxymorphone, just like they just have the word oxymorphone. And what the evidence at the
is it well known? Does the record show that it's well known that 14-hydroxymorphone in an oxymorphone salt would also be a salt?
Yes, Your Honor. Both experts agreed to that it could not exist in the free base form. This was a fascinating argument because neither Teva nor their experts in the first trial occurred to them. It certainly didn't occur to the patent office that this was the construction of the claims, or the patent office would never have allowed it. The district court made factual findings that people often use the word oxymorphone or ABOC without adding salt, just like they don't add freebase every time they say oxymorphone, and that the only way to construe the claims was the way he construed them. Here he did it based on underlying factual evidence, which is entitled to deference under Teva. But I want to make one final point, which is that this is a trial which actually should never have happened because we should have been granted summary judgment on collateral estoppel against Teva. We had a case against Teva. They lost. The product is exactly the same product as is at issue in this case, yet the district judge had us go through the trial the second time. Now, that would be harmless error if you affirm, but it does create an issue of potential problematic application in the future, that if a generic can lose a case, set up a subsidiary. I understand they bought the subsidiary here, but analytically there's not much difference between setting up a new subsidiary that's totally under your control and filing another ANDA on the same product. The distinction here is not that Teva owned the stock of Actavis. That's not sufficient. But the evidence that we obtained after the trial was that Teva controlled the communications with the FDA, and most importantly, Teva was making the launch decision on the Actavis ANDA.
So you got this information after the trial.
That's right.
So it's not in the record.
No, it's in the record. The merger took place in the run-up to trial. We asked the court to grant summary judgment on collateral estoppel. He said, no, we'll go through the trial. We got some discovery. We filed summary judgment on that point after the trial. It merged into the record. Now, granted, the reason for collateral estoppel is judicial economy, and here we've had the trial, so there's not much economy to be had, but
Also, could we here, as a matter of fact, decide exactly what the relationship between Teva and Actavis is?
It's in the record. It's in the record. Those facts are in the record, and they're cited in our brief.
Well, were they adjudicated?
It was adjudicated that it didn't matter.
Did the other side have a chance to cross-examine what you were putting in? A cross-examination record made on the facts, the control facts?
Yes, there were depositions taken of Teva witnesses and activist witnesses that they defended, and then we submitted that evidence.
And that hasn't been, but there was no fact-finding by the district court.
What the district court said was...
I have to go to that issue.
What the district court said is it didn't matter because that wasn't sufficient privity. He ruled as a matter of law that because the activists had been acquired as by way of an acquisition, that it didn't...
Yeah, well, that may be a legal error, but what I'm trying to get at is what the factual underpinnings are.
I don't think the factual underpinnings are in dispute. I believe it's a pure legal error.
Anything else,
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, is Teva in front of us?
Teva was joined into this case.
I know. Do you represent them? Are they in front of us? You represent activists.
I represent activists. Teva was also named as a defendant in
this
particular...
Your other side just told me that you're representing Teva. Teva controls your client.
Yeah, Teva and activists... Teva owns activists. Activists is a separate legal entity. The district court heard the evidence...
You heard what he said. I mean, my view was that the district court might have gotten a little bit wrong in how he chose to deal with the collateral estoppel issue, but I thought there were some underlying facts that might have to be ventilated.
No, I think that the...
Do you concede that Teva sufficiently controls activists?
No, what I would say is that the district court heard their argument, saw the evidence that he is referring to. The district court exercised its discretion. The question is discretionary under Park Lane Hosiery on whether or not you apply issue preclusion offensively.
I'm asking about fact-finding. Did the district court make these fact-findings?
The district court has two pages of its opinion addressing this issue and rejects the notion that their facts are sufficient to establish privity. So I think the district court made factual conclusions to find that what they offered was not sufficient to establish privity, and I think that should be enough. And in any event,
you would say we could review that issue independently here.
If we said
the district court judge was wrong on the facts and that Teva controls Atavis.
I think you would have to review it deferentially because it is ultimately a question of abuse of discretion by the district court in the posture in which it arises because the application of offensive...
We don't know which specific findings the district court made because it didn't say so in its opinion.
I don't think his opinion goes through and parses in great specificity, but he does consider the facts that they have offered and rejects them. Judge Wallach, I see I'm essentially out of time. If you would grant me leave, I would like to respond to the arguments.
I'll give you another minute.
Okay. So Dung did what they say that Gokul should have done. Again, that's Appendix 3038 or 3042. And the question in this case is, did the district court do a proper analysis of reasonable expectation of success? He doesn't address it at all. The only place he addresses it, you identified it, Judge Stoll, he says not one word about what a person of ordinary skill in the art would expect from Chapman or from Weiss. And indeed, there was testimony from the inventor of Dung that what the differences that you have are essentially the kinds of things that would come out of routine optimization. You can see it, Appendix 3224 and 3041. There was no finding that there's no reasonable expectation of success vis-a-vis Chapman. The only finding was that there was no definitive solution. And if there had been a definitive solution, that would be anticipation. That's the wrong standard. And
do you think that the court got confused?
Definitive solution you keep pointing to, you said the district court used those words?
Yes.
At what page?
Appendix 24. It's the carryover sentence from 23 to 24. Judge Stoll, I'm sorry, your question.
I was just going to ask you, do you think that the idea that you have to have your combination enable the claim and the idea of reasonable expectation of success, do you think those got confused by the district court?
I think they may have been. I think there also is a flavor in the district court's opinion that smells a little bit as though he was thinking about this through the lens of inherent anticipation, which, of course, something must necessarily be present. I think that's right. And one last point, if Judge Wallach, you'll allow me, and that is this. Much was said about the idea that Mallinckrodt did all kinds of experiments, but let's be clear. If you look at page 32 of their red brief, footnote 9, they didn't do experiments with oxymorphone. The experiments they did were with oxycodone, and that's significant because in the OxyContin case, low ABUK oxycodone was held to be obvious, and this court affirmed in the Purdue case. So all this stuff that he wants to tell you we did this and we did this and it was hard, well, that goes to whether or not you can make low ABUK oxycodone,
your sentence,
which was found to be obvious, and this court affirmed. And I would submit that the court here should therefore reverse. Thank you, Judge Wallen.
Thank you, Mr. O'Quinn. To strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield, Mr. O'Quinn.
Thank you.
Google that and you'll know why I just said it.